Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Let's have a look at the front pages before we meet our panel. So the Business Post is leading with FG Minister slam Taoiseach over EU trade deal shambles. So what Megan O'Brien and Sarah Collins are saying that Micheál Martin's last minute attempt to U-turn in favour of the Mercosur trade deal has sparked fury among Fine Gael ministers in the coalition. They do make a point in this piece that has been made by a few people during the week. One senior cabinet source saying, ultimately, if you really believe that the right thing was to vote for it, the groundwork hadn't been done. That debate hadn't happened. The debate was kind of owned by the beef industry in a way. And it was hard to see where the people were out softening us up for accepting Mercosur. They also have an exclusive that data centres are to be allowed in Dublin once more. The Sunday Independent are saying that an energy shortage is putting transport projects at risk. So they are saying that the people building the metro will be limited in how much energy they can use during critical times of the day, such as in the evening, when electricity demand surges around mealtime. So we'll have to stop building the metro for tea time. The Sunday Times, US makes 12,000 military flights into Irish airspace, and critics say the nation has become a vassal state over the past decade. Irish Sunday Mirror is leading with Ardara in County Donegal, a town in shock, they say, after the violent death of one of its most treasured figures. And this is the funeral yesterday of publican Stephen McCahill. The Mail is leading with more on the finances of the Peter McVerry Trust. And The Sun and The Sunday World both are leading on the death of Oisin Redden, who was murdered by his father, Wayne O'Reilly. And obviously there's still a lot of questions to be answered around the various circumstances leading to this suspected murder-suicide. Now, it's been a big week in the parish and beyond, I think it's fair to say. And we have a heavyweight panel today to take us lightly through it and make sense of it all. Eamon Ryan is chair of the European Housing Advisory Board and former leader of the Green Party and government minister. Professor Bridget Laffin is emeritus professor at the European University Institute. Dan O'Brien is chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs and a currency columnist. And Mary Regan is political editor of the Irish and Sunday Independent. Dan is a columnist with the currency, is probably a better way of putting that, rather than a currency columnist. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Look, there's a sense, guys, that a lot of the stuff we'll be going through today is all interrelated, and so we will like find our way through it and break it down a bit. But I suppose, Dan, there is a general sense after this week, and this is something that I think you've touched on before in here, but that we are potentially living in a world that has been completely reshaped into that. You know, we used to be concerned that Russia was looking for a sphere of influence, that now it has been completely reshaped into spheres of influence of big powers, where small countries are, in the words of whoever was cribbing about the air flights there, vassal states. Who take the knee to these great powers. There's a sense of David McWilliams writing yesterday, we're back to the days of the East India Company. There's a sense that colonialism almost is on the rise again. Just before we get into the specifics of all the various conflict areas and our place in it all, broadly speaking, is the world being completely reshaped in a week?
Not in a week. Go back 10 years ago. Obama was in the White House and China was a much less significant player. It was still in its hide and bide moment of rising. So China was not an aggressive player. Under the current, now has made himself president for life, Xi Jinping, is a very aggressive. It's wolf warrior diplomacy. It's a superpower and it's an aggressive superpower. Clearly, over the last year, we've seen the US completely flip. The current Trump administration is totally unlike the first Trump administration. Two superpowers in the world are predatory states. The whole idea of international rule of law, these things have gone out the window. We are now in a world of two superpowers who are predators, and we, small countries and Europe, we're on the menu. And it is a very difficult position. And to make matters worse, of the second tier powers in the world, we have on our eastern flank the most aggressive militaristic one, and that is Russia. So Europe's geopolitical predicament has transformed from the 30 years after 1989, which were a glorious period of geopolitical position, particularly for small countries. And that has totally changed. We are now in a new world of predatory superpowers, and that is going to be very, very difficult for small countries and even Europe as a whole to deal with.
Bridget, how do you see the tectonic plates right now?
So I agree broadly with what Dan has said. And I think there are now only two powers in the world that can determine the nexus, the system, because we're moving from one form of global order to disorder, but there may be a new equilibrium.
And are we moving as well? Again, back to David McWilliams, I'm thinking now from like after, it's 6 months or a year ago, I don't know, like, you know, the way time has become elastic now at this stage, saying we are a country with soft power in a world of hard power. Have we moved to, a might is right situation?
We have moved to a situation where power is might and might is right, and we've returned to resource imperialism, not unlike the 19th century, different of course because it's a different time, and we can't rely on international law or norms in the way we thought we could. And so for this is much more difficult for small states to navigate, much more difficult for Europe. And unless Europe in the next 5 years attains measures of hard power, we're even in more trouble.
When you say measures of hard power,
I think we're talking about
armies.
Guns,
yeah, because we have a bigger population than America. We have a bigger market than America. We on those old measures, like we should be the greater power, but it's down to guns now.
Well, we allowed our security and defence to it was there was a degradation of military capacity in Europe. We over relied on the United States, despite all the warnings. Now, everything is much sharper and it's much clearer.
Okay, Eamon Ryan, I presume you would be somebody who's traditionally not in favour of the kind of what you might call the military industrial complex. You picked a piece by Tim Marshall in the Sunday Times today, Carving Up the Planet. Is that what's going on, do you think?
Yes, and it is, as Bridget just said, I think it's imperialism around getting and holding and using resources. The attack in Venezuela, the abduction of the Venezuelan president, as Tim Marshall's writing in the paper today, I don't think actually that's primarily about oil. As the American oil industry itself said, it doesn't really want to go back into Venezuela. It's not investable. But it has significant critical minerals, nickel, bauxite, aluminium, gallium, some of the minerals you need for the new semiconductor industries. And I do think a lot of what the Trump administration is doing there in Latin America is its resource imperialism. Can I just make 2 points of to come back to what Dan was saying? I think there's a slight difference in the sense with the American and Chinese positions, because China, whatever your views, they still ostensibly stand by international law, the United Nations and other mechanisms. You can agree or disagree on that, but I would make that difference. Because I think what has changed, and time is elastic here, but since the 5th of December, everything has changed. Because America came out with its national security strategy and was explicit in three things, effectively, three key messages. Firstly, that they have hegemony over the Western Hemisphere and they can do what they want to assert their power and get whatever they want. Secondly, they want to undermine the European Union explicitly and publicly. And thirdly, they want to undermine any action on climate change. That's where they are in the oil industry, vested interests control them. I think we're at the start, the early stages of what can you only describe as what I would call it a climate war. They're engaged in warfare now. It's a psychological warfare. One of the key battlefront is not just guns. It's also disinformation, fake news. What is truth? That's the first most important defence issue we have to look and think about. Secondly, it is bullying and using and trying to undermine institutions. And thirdly, it is trade wars. So this war has been played out, not just in weapons, but actually in all those levers.
Back to the climate war for a second, and I do. There's lots of stuff to move on to, so I will move on. But the climate war is an interesting one. I think it was Ezra Klein who said, it's like the 1980s when we're arguing about cocaine and oil. It's like Dallas all over again. It's as if the Green Revolution never happened for the Americans in a way, is it?
is a pushback completely. I still believe the vast majority of the American people see it as real and want it addressed. But they allowed it to become a subject of identity politics, cultural war, put it into that sort of framing, which allowed them assault on it.
So that people's truth is dictated not by what they see.
And paid for by vested oil and gas and other interests.
Okay.
In my mind, are influencing American government policy for their gain and the private gain of the Trump family. That's what's happening.
Yeah, and we did. I only realised during the week that the boss of Chevron has been in Trump's ear all the time. He's very close to him. Trump phones him a lot. This only kind of really emerged around the Venezuela thing. Mary, we won't make people anxious. Like, we'll stay calm about all this. But I think there is a sense of anxiety around. What I wonder is, do you get the sense from talking to our politicians and the discourse around Leinster House and everything, are they freaking out, thinking like everything's changing around them, the whole way we have of doing things and everything has been upended?
Yeah, well, I guess to say that, you know, politicians all know now that we're all just living in Donald Trump's world and we're all just going along for the ride. So that's an unpredictable, it's a directionless journey for many of them. And it makes government, I would say, quite hard because you're competing international interests and international purposes with domestic politics and what wins votes at the end of the day. And, you know, I think there were two things that happened since the start of the year, which feels like a million years ago now, in Trump's world. And one of them being the Venezuela issue. And that's a sort of longer term problem for Ireland, because many view that as a sort of tearing up of the international rules-based order. The problem for Ireland there is that was a sort of rules and conventions that Ireland managed to navigate very well throughout the years with relationships with Europe, relationships with the US. And we don't know what the sort of new rule book will be now and if Ireland will be in any way suited to it. And I don't think it probably will.
And we were doing fairly well under the old rule book. Exactly. We had it good.
And the other one then, the other development being Greenland, that is more of a sort of immediate problem as Irish politicians would see it, because, you know, just listening to Stephen Miller, Trump's deputy chief of staff, basically refusing to rule out any sort of using military force on Greenland, in essence, that is also refusing to, you know, use military force on, you know, sovereign territory of Denmark, which is the European Union. So Irish politicians will look with extreme worry about what the European response to this will be, because Europe will have to respond if there is a claim to Greenland. And what will happen in terms of sanctions, for example, on US, that's already been talked about by Greenland, by other European
countries.
So us
trying to ride both horses.
The horses are going further apart all the time.
Yeah, okay.
But when it comes down to it, really, at the end of the day, most politicians will look at whether they get voted in the next general election or not. And that means what's happening in their own backyard. In the case of many TDs this week, what was actually happening in their own cattle sheds mattered as much as what was happening on the international stage.
Okay. That's, you don't know how that fits the situation. Bridget, on that, Matt Cooper has a good piece in the Sunday Business Post, Turmoil to the Left, Danger to the Right. Ireland in a world of peril. So our place in all of this.
So Ireland is a small state. As you said, we benefited enormously. We were the poster child of globalisation. And that world is now gone and has now ended. And so for us, the question is, how does Ireland ensure a slice of global prosperity so that we can run the state, collect taxes, etc., etc.? And that's much harder in the world we're facing into. And the problems are within Europe, beyond Europe, and our relationship with the United States. So we've got to determine what are our core anchors for this world. One important anchor is our membership of the EU. Without it, we're rudderless. And so the question is, what does our opposition to Mercosur do to our place in the EU? At one level, it'll be seen as Irish domestic politics, and it was all Irish domestic politics. But it was also a shambles and very badly handled, and that will be seen. Secondly, there was a quid pro quo. We got the derogation of nitrates extended, and we didn't then come behind Mercosur. So I would say that the next time in Ireland we want another derogation, or we have another big ask, it'll be harder for us, both with the Commission and the other member states. And then you have a situation where we oppose by Europe. We say European content, that's protectionist. But opposition to Mercosur was protection.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do we evaluate the trade-offs and be clear in how we navigate this world?
So we need to try and find some consistency in
and we need
on
it
that.
With the US as well. And of course, the US has become much more complex as well. So I think we're at a stage where what kind of Ireland, in what kind of Europe, in what kind of world? And if I were, because I think what we also should understand from Mercosur was our domestic political system and engagement with the Irish public on where we are was appalling, a shambles.
Yeah. Eamon Ryan, can I ask you about it? In terms of, were you observing the relationship between the parties to government and the leaders this week, or what we could glean of it? I'm thinking back to your time when the relationships between you and Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin, say, there was this kind of, you know, no surprises, no, and you apparently quite pragmatic in the middle of it, even though you might have been coming from a different place to them, and it was about keeping things calm and showing a united front. Have those, do you think those relationships in the current government are very different?
I do, but can I maybe just first of all make a point on the Mercosur?
No, we'll come back to Mercosur.
Okay, then.
Will you tell me that one first, and I promise you we'll talk about Mercosur.
Yes, I do, and I think it's true what's been written in the papers today, what Bridget just said. This was very badly managed internally. I can't imagine the way it works is you, that sort of, if you're going to change your position and go against something in your own programme for government, you would first of all address that at leaders' level, at party leaders. And that might, may includes, it's different in this government because the independents, it doesn't seem to me, had the, quite the same role that we had in the previous government. But I can't imagine in this instance that the Taoiseach hadn't agreed with the Taoiseach to the broad approach he wanted to take in advance of him going to China.
So you don't think that what he said in China would have come as a surprise to the Healy Rays or Simon Harris
it may have
or,
come
or,
a surprise
or the independents?
To Healy Rays, because I don't think they are as integrated into government in the same way that, for example, we would have been. But I can't imagine in Fine Gael that that position wouldn't have been taken without it being cleared. Maybe not with every... What you do is you agree it first at leaders' level, then you go to cabinet subcommittee, then you go to cabinet. And in that... I think it looks like that didn't happen.
None of that happened.
But I can't imagine the first step didn't happen. It's just one of the examples of why I think this was not managed, and I think it's going. I agree with Bridget. I think it won't do fatal damage for us. It's not the issue isn't here purely but reputational. It's just it's about coherence and capability politically, and that was not shown this week, or indeed in the weeks up to it. Going right back, I would argue, to the 5th of December, we should have been rethinking our strategy even from that point because we realised we were in a different world.
Okay, so you would have been for Mercosur.
Historically, and my view is a personal one, now not a Green Party one.
Yes, and indeed the Green Party have asked us to distance themselves from your views in Mercosur. It is not their view in Ireland or throughout Europe.
But I would say to my European Green colleagues, the first question now is, how are our MEPs going to vote? And I include in that, because that's not certain that it will get through the Parliament. I believe we should vote in support. I fully accept and understand the criticisms and the reason that the Green Party are arguing against it because of the weakening of environmental standards. What you heard the farmers saying in Athlone yesterday, that why should we have all the traceability in other conditions and others not? So I absolutely accept that point. But I sometimes think there's a bigger picture, and the bigger picture of this, in the week when that US security doctrine was rolled out, with the abduction of a Latin American president, with the direct threat in Europe, in Denmark, we had the opportunity, or we do still have the opportunity, to say Europe and Latin America stands in solidarity together against that sort of aggressive behaviour. And that's why I think actually our MEPs should consider supporting Mercosur.
Mary, can I come back to you? And you're writing about this yourself today, and you've picked a piece in the Business Post. I'll go back to the broader issue in a minute with Dan maybe, but just on the politics of what happened here, like, it was a mess, wasn't it? So now Sunday Business Post today, FG Minister slam Taoiseach over EU trade deal shambles. In your piece, you were talking to Martin Hayden and Regina Doherty. As far as I can see, Martin Hayden was saying to you, the farmers don't need to worry about Mercosur. It's going to be okay. There's plenty in place. But this is the guy who's against Mercosur. Regina Doherty is saying she's going to vote for it. What's going on?
Well, I think he's trying to ease the concerns of farmers there. And, you know, this deal is going ahead. So I suppose the government has to in some way reassure farmers that some of the safeguards they got will go, you know, some way. But in terms of the politics of this, it was very poorly handled, and people across government will accept that, because I think what Micheál Martin said in China on Wednesday, when he appeared to be softening his stance for Ireland to support Mercosur at this EU vote, it took so many people by surprise.
Now, did it take Simon Harris by surprise, or would you agree with Eamon that it would have been run by Simon Harris?
Well, according to the Business Post today, Fine Gael ministers were taken by surprise on this. But listening to what Eamon says and the structures that would be in place between Simon Harris and the Taoiseach, that should not have been the case. And just before I came in here, my mind was cast back this morning to a doorstep Simon Harris did about this at the start of December. And he was asked what would happen if the blocking minority couldn't be formed. The blocking minority being if France, Italy in particular, and then Ireland and other countries got together, they'd have enough votes to block this. And that's what Ireland was seeking all along. Then it appeared last week that Italy wasn't going to form the blocking minority, so it no longer existed. But Simon Harris was asked at the start of December, what if this blocking minority couldn't be formed? And he said, well, I've never been interested in performative politics, which to me suggests, well, you can interpret that in many other ways, but to me, in terms of Mercosur, suggested that he felt it would have been performative politics to vote against it when it was already going to go ahead anyway. So that would suggest that, you know, perhaps there was a softening in government across the board about Mercosur earlier this week. But then what happened is Micheál Martin said what he said in China. Martin Hayden then, around the same time or a little while later, was in Brussels, and he said that he took a very negative view of Mercosur. People in Fine Gael read that as a signal from Fine Gael that they wouldn't stand for it. Then there were the independents in the government, but then the Fianna Fáil WhatsApp group on Wednesday night, this was a sort of, you know, what would be like a Fianna Fáil PP meeting, except it was all happening on WhatsApp, and they came out so strongly, and some of the comments from people who would be considered Micheál Martin loyalists. And it just shows, I think, that Micheál Martin doesn't have a huge amount of political capital within his party, that he had to kind of go along with what his backbenchers were saying.
Yeah, okay. So if he hadn't been in such in that weaker position, he might have been able to.
But the other thing is, if it was the case that they were going to back Mercosur, because it was going to pass anyhow, the groundwork wasn't done. And that's the point that's been made by some ministers, in the sense that it took people by surprise. So they should have started talking about this a month or two back that this was a possibility.
Yeah.
And no one was saying Mercosur could be good for Ireland. You know, all we heard was a lot of negativity around Mercosur.
Yeah, Eamon Ryan, I'm thinking of, was it Leo Varadkar said, if we keep doing business like this, we won't be doing business for long. Like, the Minister for Agriculture out in Brussels responding to the Taoiseach in China negatively, and then a WhatsApp group kicking off and the whole thing getting derailed, sounds chaotic. Dan,
can I just want to add to that? The important thing is what, and we're getting into the papers today, what the Commission are saying. And what they're saying is that they believed there was a quid pro quo in getting the derogation.
And the nitrates derogation.
In response, we would, that was their, and their anger is palpable. And what Bridget says is true. If we're going back to look for an extension of the derogation, I think the chances are slim to nil now.
Okay.
Or any other ask, particularly from agriculture or environment.
Okay, Dan?
Yeah, well, in this new world, I think we need a relentless focus on the national interest. And this whole Mercosur fiasco has underscored again, as we've seen with issues around security and defence, that this government is not capable of analysing and prioritising the national interest. This deal was overwhelmingly in our national interest. It was economically in our national interest, because we were going to win far more than whatever small losses would come about for one small industry, the beef industry. It was in our European interest, because post-Brexit we've been trying to ally ourselves with the Northern Europe free trading countries, and now we look ridiculous. It's in our geopolitical interest, because we need to diversify trade with places in the world that are not going to weaponize it. So the Latin Americans are not in any position to weaponize trade against us. So it was in our interests in every way. And as Mary said, we've had 25 years to articulate those interests, and the government has completely failed to do it and caved in. It's a very bad indicator in terms of how this government is able to identify and articulate our vital national interests.
Okay, you'd agree that beef farmers are going to lose out here. I mean, we're going from, is it 35% tariffs to 7.5% on beef? There's going to be South American beef
There will be a little bit more because the amount of extra Latin American beef that can come in on the basis of this deal is a fraction of European production. So it will at most...
Yeah, but I think they would make the point that it will have a disproportionate effect on Ireland because we are such a huge exporter of beef.
Okay, who consumes more? Who consumes the most Irish beef? Britain. So what we, the Irish farmers really need to worry about is when the British do a Mercosur deal, and if they... don't have a quota. There's the amount, as I say, the amount of extra beef that will come in because of this deal is tiny relative to the European market. If Britain opens up its market, really opens up its market, because this is a sort of small little thing. If Britain opens up its market, where much more Irish beef is consumed compared to in Ireland, even the home market, then the farm, the beef industry is in real trouble. And that's the risk.
One point on that, and go back to the wider picture, where what will happen now?
Do we look ridiculous, Eamon Ryan? As Dan says.
This, I believe it was the wrong decision.
Do we look ridiculous?
I don't think we look ridiculous. We are.
Bridget, do you think we look ridiculous?
So I think Dan's point about Irish national interest, because if you read a lot of what we say about our foreign policy today, the phrase "we have a value-led foreign policy" is the big phrase we use. That is totally unsuited to the world in which we live in, and we've got to actually say broadly what are the important things for Ireland. We're vulnerable to the US in terms of trade, hugely vulnerable economically. Therefore, we've got to hedge and diversify.
And maybe calm down on our values. Mary, you wanted to come in there.
Just, you could also argue that we'd also look ridiculous if the coalition was destabilised. And I think, you know, that's not under...
And it was in the programme for government as well.
It was in the programme for government.
They got elected on opposing
markets. Many TDs say that they were elected on. And many TDs would argue that they would be breaching a promise, that they would be caught completely offside with so many of the people that they represent. So they're saying this was a sort of democratic input into the leadership, and that it potentially would have been destabilising, because you could have got a few, maybe two, might have been small, but government backbenchers, for example, overboard and leaving the coalition over this. So it would have damaged Micheál Martin, I think, internally, if he had gone.
Okay, Eamon, briefly.
With that, and that's why I think we're not ridiculous. We have a stable, well-functioning political system. We make mistakes, but at least we can correct, course correct. One of the points I make, just to respond to what Dan said about Britain, which is true. What is the response going to be to this situation we're in? It will be much stronger European integration, in my mind. And part of that will be the reintegration of the UK back into our European systems. That's what we need to be pushing for. And that's the reputational damage that's been done, because that's going to go out, and particularly with the presidency ahead of us, where we have that potential to act on the global stage, okay, which we do. I don't agree that values-led politics is time has passed. I think it's actually needed more than ever.
But I agree with you. But we have also got to be able to articulate what are Ireland's interests. And we tend not to use the word interest anymore. And that's hypocritical, because of course we have interests and of course we pursue them.
Okay, let's move on to another aspect.
Just make
it
once, a tiny little thing. Yeah. Programme for Government mentions Mercosur once. Before Mercosur, it says the current Mercosur deal.
Yeah.
A lot has changed since a year ago. So the government gave itself lots of wiggle room, because it said the current, and it could easily have said the...
I notice everybody is still saying this week the deal as it stands now. So maybe they're hoping to get a bit more, get caught a bit more slack out of it. Dan, I want to go on to, speaking of values and speaking of our beef, a country that doesn't take any of our beef at the moment, China. You were looking at David Quinn's piece about Micheál Martin and China. Martin is no gadfly. That's why China rolled out the red carpet.
Yeah, a very good piece by David, highlighting, as I said earlier, that hide and bide way that after the end of the Mao era in the 70s, that China had this sort of very gradual, you know, win-win. Everyone was going to get win from China's rise, and it wasn't going to be aggressive, and how things have changed. And he sort of questions, the Taoiseach spent the last 4 days or 4 days last week in China enhancing relations. So, you know, David's piece is looking, is this a good idea? And again, coming back to interests, I do not think it's in Ireland's interests to get closer to China. We're already very close. We always have
a huge trading relationship with
very
them,
big trading relationship there. I think our fifth biggest trading partner, bigger than France. You know, France is a huge...
Why is that not in our interest? Back to Bridget's
because the Chinese weapon, like the Americans under the current administration, are very willing and quick to weaponize trade if they want. Their main interest in Ireland is having somebody who can put their position in the EU. they're not particularly interested in a country like, you know, they have 100 cities with populations bigger than us. The gains for China of relations with us are mainly about how we could do things that they want in an EU context. And they're very good at picking off individual countries. And this is something I think Ireland needs to be very careful about.
It is true that China can weaponize trade rules. For example, they threatened to cut off access to the rare earths to Europe last year, which was an incredible threat. It has since somewhat been pulled back. But in the choice, what our interests are is not, in my mind, moving towards a European-China trade war protectionist dividing down to these blocks. And at least, as I said earlier on with China, there are mechanisms. That's what Artishuk was doing there this week, to look to see, are there mechanisms in a world where America is going completely rogue, that the other main sectors, and you have to include the developing world in this, it has to be a global response, and Latin America, can you avoid us going into tripping into protectionist resource-based wars? And I think that is still possible with China, and I think the Taoiseach's visit was probably one of the most important events politically that we were there able to advance that agenda. I think we should continue to do it.
You'd be the first person to be saying he should be. I think he did mention the Jimmy Lai case, but I thought you'd be the first person, Eamon Ryan, to say that if the Taoiseach should go out there all guns blazing about the Uyghurs, about oppression across China.
What David Quinn said in his article
to Taiwan about
what David Quinn said in his article is correct. You raised that. But if you go in and try and put that on the first item and nothing but that, you will not be able to actually sit down and then discuss some of these issues. I've been there with those Chinese ministers in Beijing. And yes, you stand up, because one of the things we do stand up is for international order and justice. But you do that in a diplomatic way as part of an overall. It's in our interest overall to advance those values, but also to try and avoid us going into a protectionist trade war.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Eamon Ryan, Professor Bridget Laffin, Dan O'Brien and Mary Regan staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Eamon Ryan, Professor Bridget Laffin, Dan O'Brien and Mary Regan. There's a text here. I wouldn't like to be Michal going to Washington in March with a miserable bowl of shamrock. It might remind Trump that Ireland is there and he could decide to take us over. Mary Regan, you've been looking at Katrina Perry has an excellent piece in the Sunday Independent, Why US Tough Talk Should Worry Ireland, and a Sunday Times piece as well on a similar note.
Yes, and it's, Katrina Perry is making the point that we sort of spoke about earlier, you know, along the lines that the sort of position that Ireland could be left in if there is any attempt to forcibly, you know, make inroads on Greenland, and Europe has to respond. Europe might respond with sanctions or other diplomatic means, and that, she says, will leave Ireland caught between Berlin and Boston, potentially with an enormous decision to make. But both Katrina Perry's piece and the piece by Katie Balls in the Sunday Times reference Trump's problems, his more domestic problems, which are perhaps being overlooked when everyone is examining his foreign policy. Firstly, in the Sunday Times, there was a little aside which I thought was interesting, where she mentions backroom people, I presume in the White House, joking along the lines that why can't Baron Trump just marry the Princess of Denmark, then Greenland can be the wedding gift. And yeah, I actually looked up the Princess of Denmark just to see, you know, out of curiosity.
Is she of marriageable age, is it?
And this is actually the first thing that comes up when you look up the Princess of Denmark is, you know, all this theory online about why she should marry Baron Trump. So it's not as fanciful as we
No,
might
and
seem.
These things that start out as daft memes, as we know, can often become reality very quickly. Yeah.
Apparently. Anyhow, that would be the Disney version of events. But both pieces speak about the sort of problems Trump is facing back home, and many in the Republican Party's sort of, flexing their muscles a little bit more, and the fact that midterm elections are coming up around the corner, and that American people do not vote on foreign policy. They vote on domestic issues, the cost of living crisis, and, you know, a failure to make sort of inroads on housing problems similar to here could be what really damage things.
So. Yeah, and I think she says in that as well that polling-wise, most people against the Venezuela move. It's in one of the pieces anyway. Mm. And polling wise, most people against any annexation of Greenland. Dan, on that, Colin Murphy has an interesting piece in the Sunday Independent, why Trump's ambition may soon hit an iceberg.
Yeah, he talks to probably one of the most influential Irish people in the world that you've never heard of, a guy called Tom Wright, who worked for the Biden White House as a security advisor. So he discusses with Tom Wright. Wright's view is that Trump wants Greenland not for security reasons, but because he wants to be a sort of historic president. And he equates it with the purchase, the Louisiana purchase from the French in the early 19th century, and then the purchase from Russia of Alaska in the second half of the 19th century. So he thinks that's why Trump wants Greenland.
And see, there is this theory that it's just he wants to make America bigger. And it's as simple as that.
And that's what happened with those two previous cases. And if that's the case, then we're in serious trouble, because Ireland, like other countries, quite rightly calibrated their response. They didn't criticise the Venezuela situation because they realise it's not fundamentally in our interests to fall out with the US over Venezuela. At the same time, we realise that annexing a part of European territory by anyone, whether it's Russia, whether it's America, is an absolute no-no. We can't tolerate that. And if that happens, then I think we're heading for an economic war with the US, because I don't think the Europeans are going to be willing to do what they did last summer, look, trade and roll over.
Look, none of us know anything, but most informed people seem to be saying that there is no way that Trump is going to take it by force, despite what Trump keeps saying. And a lot of people do think that the Greenlanders, they want their independence overwhelmingly, but I think their general consensus there is that they take it at a slow pace. They are given 700 million a year by Denmark at the moment. They want to wean off that a bit and be independent, and that with some sort of free association with America could help them to that end.
Well, hopefully that'll be the case, and there can be a way worked around this. But with somebody like Trump, you simply cannot rule out the possibility that he simply sends US forces in. The Danes are not going to, nobody's going to die over this, because the Danes are, no, they're not going to be able to keep the Americans out militarily. But that will mean that the US doing effectively what Trump, what Putin has done. And the Europeans, you know, everything has changed since 2022. Europeans have surprised themselves by their resolve over the war in Ukraine and Putin's invasion of Ukraine. I think they will do the same thing, that this will become an issue that we simply can't back down on. You cannot allow people to take your territory and not do anything about it.
On the other hand, Eamon Ryan, there seems to be a general view that if they just walked up the main street, reminiscent of shooting someone on Fifth Avenue, if they walked up the main street and planted an American flag there, no one's going to do anything about it.
They shot someone in Minneapolis last week.
Yeah.
Well, I was surprised reading the papers today how little that featured. Because I think that actually was the most terrifying. Well, was it Stalin said you could lose a division, but you know what would notice, but you have the story of an individual life lost.
Yeah.
That actually changes everything. And I think that shooting does change things. I can't imagine in my friends and my cousins in the States that there will not be a point coming, please God, soon, where they say, no, this is not acceptable. This is not right. And that is key.
I was even surprised watching the protests last night that they're not overwhelming protests.
I think the fact that it's a mother in a sort of car that you could imagine any of us, you know, kind of down.
I'm not questioning how shocking it is, but I'm just saying that what you're saying about how inured people are to it, how the papers aren't full of it today, that the protests, they're not burning down the streets in Minneapolis.
Because she was a protester, in my mind, doing really important, brave work. Will that dissuade people from doing that in the States? That's going to be the key question the next 6 months.
I think this also...
Or do people hold the line and say, no, we really, really, really are not going to allow this happen?
There's also a concern there as well, which is also very worrying, that if bigger protests break out, they'll sort of give Trump an excuse, you know, like to go further or to, you know, send in federal guard or whatever, you know. So there's actually a reticence to protest, which in itself is worrying.
Yeah, I mean, when you have Tim Walz talking about bringing out the National Guard to protect the citizens from another arm of the state.
I was saying to Bridget Owen, which I was going to say, it's like the Black and Tans. they're literally in black and tan outfits, masked. And you made the point, well, they're from their own country, so that's a difference.
But
I think
it's,
I think that's where Americans need to come up and say, we will not, we will fight the black and tans here.
Bridget, do you think a Rubicon was crossed?
Yes, because the ICE agents are clearly untrained. This was
this guy now, it should be said, let's be careful on facts, had 20 years experience. A lot of them, yes, the training has been cut down, I think, from 6 months to 6 weeks. They're being hired in with 50 grand bonuses and there's a vague 30s element to the recruitment posters as well. And there's all that. This guy had been border force, I think, and had 20 years experience.
But there's a big difference between being a border force at a border and being on a street with civilians.
Yeah.
And he had ample opportunity to not pull that gun. I mean, I've looked at those videos from all angles several times. This was a completely unnecessary. He was not protecting himself. He was not under attack. His life was not in danger. And a woman who had just dropped a six-year-old to a school ends up dead. And I do think, I think this year, the most important thing that, well, lots of important things will happen, but the midterms are really important. If he manages to navigate the midterms, then we should worry not just about what the US does to the world, but what the US does to itself. And I, again, the shock that someone can't drop a child to a school without being surrounded by men in balaclavas. I mean, that is democracy.
And I gather there was an element of they were, I think, protesting and trying to obstruct ICE and everything. That is no excuse for any of it. Gardaí in Ireland are routinely goaded and driven to all kinds of distraction at protests. You do not take out a gun and shoot someone in the face.
Just quickly go back to Greenland. I think, If in a worst case scenario, then European-US relations, it's a deep rupture. But I suspect there'll be an off-ramp solution, not just because the Europeans will react. I think within the United States and even within the administration, actually taking territory of a NATO member state is of another order.
Yep.
So
and we are seeing a splintering in Republicans in different ways,
so
aren't
I
we?
Think,
yeah.
I think it's... But on the other hand, I wouldn't be complacent, and nor would I be
surprised. You nearly said something positive there and then and you killed it. Well, Dan, can we move on to Iran? Because obviously, again, there's a lot going on. And look, I don't want people's heads spinning here, but I do think that this is... You're being really helpful and good here in putting a bit of perspective and a bit of calm around this. So Iran, which can seem very far away from us in one way, Dan, and irrelevant to us, but there are extraordinary events playing out there. What jumped out at you in the papers today?
Well, I saw the Sindo ran the Washington Post opinion piece of the son of the last Shah.
Yeah.
Who's shaping up, and I've never seen him take a prominent role. There have been wave after wave after wave of protests over the years against this autocratic, theocratic regime in Iran. It's really, you know, an awful regime, and clearly people want, if they had the opportunity, to get rid of it in Iran. So he's positioning himself as kind of the Spanish king did in Spain in the 70s when they transitioned from dictatorship to democracy. He's positioning himself as somebody who could come in, not as somebody who would restore the monarchy, but as somebody who would oversee that transition.
He'd need Trump's support, would he?
Certainly Trump has come out and had some very strong words for the regime. And of course, last year...
He's being a bit equivocal about Pahlavi, I think, yeah.
Yeah, but look, with Trump, you know, he's warned the Iranian regime, and, you know, he bombed one of the many astonishing things that happened last year. The US bombed Iran, sort of unthinkable.
Do you think, Dan, I mean, it's difficult to say because we don't know, again, what the shape of a collapse of the regime would be, and we don't know what would come after and everything else. On balance, a good or bad thing you would hope it would be good for those people living in this oppressive, bankruptish theocracy. But for the region and the world, would it be a good thing to see that regime collapse?
Well, certainly not in a way. There's 100 million people nearly in Iran, and that it would be a disaster if it went into a Syria-type situation, most of all for the people of Iran themselves who've suffered enough. But Iran is the great disruptor in the Middle East. It has no friends. Nobody in the Saudis, the Turks, the Israelis, whoever it is, nobody likes Iran because it is the great disruptor in the region. Now, if they went to having a sort of even a Turkey-like regime of the Erdogan, the guy who's been there for many
years. Of a illiberal kind of democracy.
And a liberal democracy that is seeking sort of, as the Gulf states are, they're looking more about prosperity and stability rather than sort of disruption and dominance, that would lead to a transformed Middle East and a much more peaceful part of the world, which, you know, would be good for everybody. But again, that issue of 100 million people descending into a Syria-type conflict, you know, refugees, huge, you know, risks around that. So we all hope that it can translate, transition quickly from an awful anti-democratic regime to something better.
Okay, we'll take a break. Eamon Ryan, Professor Bridget Laffin, Dan O'Brien and Mary Regan staying with us. Welcome back, Eamon Ryan, Professor Bridget Laffin, Dan O'Brien and Mary Regan still with us. There's a text here. Where are all the Democrats who should be calling out Trump's policies? Where is Obama? Where is Biden? Who leads the Democratic Party now? We hear nothing from them, only Republicans. Gavin Newsom, apparently. I think Gavin Newsom is our main hope at the moment. Listen, Mary, in a week of a lot of fairly revolting stuff, I think the story that most people found most personally revolting in ways was the Grok story. You've picked a piece in the Irish Mail on Sunday by Debbie McCann and Colin McGurk. And this is an interesting take on it. Teenagers using AI to sexualize classmates may face trial, but its big tech owners won't.
Yeah, this story has developed so fast over the past week. The use of Grok, this new AI tool by Elon Musk's X, which X AI, when they launched it, you know, described it as something that will allow people to have a sort of spicier use of AI, as they described it. But it's become something that's seriously worrying because of this way that people can be, the term being used is nudification apps, which I think is actually a real sort of You know, it's sort of sanitized how awful this is.
Well, it's kind of disgusting as well.
Exactly,
and this is what they're for. They're not hiding as something else and here's an accidental thing you can do with it. They are nudification.
This is how it's being used to digitally
But this is how
undress.
It's designed.
Yeah,
it's
mostly
designed.
Women
yeah.
and children.
Yeah.
And that is how it's designed specifically. And the piece in the Mail on Sunday by Debbie McCann and Colin McGurk kind of goes through the legalities of all this, which I think is something that even the policymakers themselves and the government are sort of perplexed by how the laws should apply here. But they're saying that, you know, if the person is under 18, a child, a teenager, the image is generated, a sexualized image, then it's a breach of the Child Trafficking and Pornography Act. So from that point of view, a teenage boy who digitally undresses his classmate, for example, which is what it seems to be this is being used widely for, they are breaking the law and they are, you know, potentially facing criminal sanctions for
so
that.
So if you can't talk to your sons and tell them, look, this is wrong, I give them a hard warning that what you're doing here could end you up in serious trouble.
Exactly. But again, this is the problem. It's placing all the obligations and the pressure on parents to have to deal with this and schools to have to deal with this. Whereas we know that the minister, Niamh Smith, had called in representatives from X and, you know, it took them a couple of days to reply to her, for example.
Yeah, but there is a meeting now. Yeah.
And meeting has been arranged between them. But when it comes to adults, the laws are sort of less clear because, you know, if it's an adult digitally undressing another adult, then, you know, that can come under COCO's law.
I think the sharing of it would come under
exactly.
COCO's
law.
Exactly.
So,
the creation of it.
Yeah. So the problem is doing it is not breaching the law. Sharing it is because it's illegal to share, you know, a sexually explicit image of a person. But then the question comes in, is this actually of the person when it's you know, it might be their face, but it's not an accurate
and then
image.
And there's this whole other thing. People might say, well, why would you be making one and not sharing it? Because apparently there's a concept of an AI girlfriend where you might make one for yourself of somebody you know. Tell me about shipping as well, which is another cyberbullying trend they deal with there.
So there's a principal in the Mail, Rachel O'Connor, and she's the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals, and she's saying that the biggest trend, not this digitally undressing, but the biggest form of cyberbullying and the most growing one at the moment is something called shipping, where you digitally place people in a relationship, right? So you get one kid in the school and another kid in the school, you put them together digitally to look like they're in a relationship, and then, you know, the peers or their friends or the people in the class can decide whether it's a ship, which is yes, or a dip for a no, whether they're matched or not. But she's saying that this is, you know, in some ways she says it's the digitized version of the graffiti on the back of the bathroom door, which might have existed in previous generations. And it's putting people in, you know, relationships or positions or images that they might feel very uncomfortable with, in a, you know, it might be a very junior child with a senior child, hugely sensitive around these things.
And for teachers, it's so difficult as well if they're being subject to that
kind of stuff, and using for maybe children with additional and more complex needs, that it's really distressing for them. And then Miss O'Connor, the principal here, talks about how she gets in touch with TikTok when this is happening in schools, and principals are getting in touch with TikTok, which she says, in their defence, you do, you know, tend to respond and remove these. But it just struck me that this is another thing for teachers and principals to have to worry about, getting in touch with the tech companies about things
policing
that are going on in their school.
This kind of thing, yeah.
But as well as the child protection element of this, which is hugely worrying, because this is being described now as a factory of child pornography. This is a company, by the way, that has a shiny office on Fenian Street in Dublin, X, with more than 100 people employed there, and they seem to be sort of unanswerable in many ways. They don't tend to appear before Oireachtas committees where other, you know, organisations do. Yes, they're meeting the minister, but, you know, it's so worrying, this sort of this use of children in this way. But there's also a gender element to this, because this is mainly women who are being portrayed and digitally undressed. And that has to be seen. I think this has to be seen not just in a purely, you know, whether it's freedom of expression or not, or that sort of debate. This has to be seen as a gender safety issue now, because it's going to start pushing women out of public spaces.
Yeah.
We already saw what happened Gráinne Seoighe in the Galway West election. Now, that's not to say what happened to her was why she didn't get elected, but she had to put up with that in a way that, you know, male public representatives didn't. Will that put women off, you know, public life, public office, seeking public office?
There was a woman on Drive Time the other day with Katie Hannan. It's worth looking up and listening to her. She was from England, but she just described the effect that it had on her when it happened to her. Some gym progress photo she'd put up, and it had been nudified. But she talked about how it hit so hard, because it wasn't like a drawing of her or anything else. It was her there. Mm-hmm. But it was really good. Dan, on the shiny building and everything. So the UK are talking now potentially about banning access to X in England. I saw a former employee of Elon Musk, who is now against Elon Musk, as most of his former employees are, saying the other day, he said the thing about Elon Musk is that he lives a life with no consequences. Are we going to have to show Elon Musk and X some consequences, and is that going to be awkward for us?
Well, this whole area about we're feeling our way through this new world, and it's very difficult to regulate it. It's like when the invention of printing back in the day, that we're feeling our way, and there's upsides and downsides to all this social media stuff. We're talking clearly about some of the downsides of it. Ireland does have a role in regulating, given that some of these tech companies are headquartered here. So it puts Ireland in a difficult position. Again, coming back, you know, if the US administration takes against anybody who regulates one of its tech companies, you know, we're in a difficult position.
Okay.
So it just reinforces how difficult a position we're in.
All right, listen, before we finish up, the Golden Globes are on tonight. Bridget briefly first, and then Eamon. Jessie Buckley.
So can I just say that I'm delighted that Jessie Buckley is in line. I mean, she is a serious candidate for an Oscar. She's got the Golden Globe, hasn't she? Or has she?
She got the Critics' Choice.
She got the Critics' Choice.
Yeah.
The
Golden Globe will be tonight.
A Killarney woman, and her acting in Hamlet is stunning. It's absolutely stunning. Her face alone renders her performance. Charmed.
And you say that without any county bias at all.
Oh no, completely without county bias.
You know her family.
I do. I knew the Buckleys. They have a lovely hotel in Killarney. They are beautiful. And Jessie's grandmother, Nari, was a legend. I mean, really, really impressive. And his uncle, Sean, I know well, and worked. We worked with them over the years. They were a fantastic family business. It's not surprising how brilliant she is. I can say this week was the most harrowing, disturbing, frightening, scary week. The only maybe jewel of optimism and thing that would make you smile and happy was what she said when she won those awards. She was talking about her fellow co-star, Paul Mescal. And what did she say? I could drink you like water.
Yeah.
I thought that was the best line all week.
Okay. So, look, there you go. We ended on a positive note. Well done, Eamon Ryan. We'll have you again. Thanks very much to my panel today. That was really excellent in a really, I think, what was such a complicated, confusing week for people. I think he did manage to shed a lot of light on things there. Eamon Ryan, Professor Bridget Laffin, Dan O'Brien and Mary Regan, thank you very much.